on healthcare. We're trying to get Representative Cannon on the phone to talk to us about HB 2213. We have on the schedule HB 2500. It turns out I've allowed...
Representative Cannon?
Yes, hi, Cindy.
Hi. The chair just gaveled in, and he's making a couple announcements, so hold on, please.
Thank you.
I've allowed the rural health people to make some amendments on HB 2500 to bring in, as... Turns out there were a few bills around dealing with first responders and other personnel, as well as EMTs. The suggestion was we move first responders into this bill, and along with EMTs, and we have some amendments coming on that, and they're not ready yet, so we'll postpone 2500. It would be appropriate to take it up in work session a week from today when we're talking about rural health and our televised discussion with folks around the state, and we'll carry 2500 at that time. Incidentally, for your just to think about the session next week, scheduled to go from 3 to 6, and may or may not go till 6, will be next door in Hearing Room F, because I expect... I've invited the legislators for each of the districts that were having a community to join us either here or in their home community, and I expect a little bit more of a crowd here. Incidentally, Sandy, can I ask you if Representative Maurer and Richardson are attending at the site in Medford, and I'm not sure that's the case. Will they still count as a quorum being in Medford?
I will double check that, Mr. Yeah. Chair, but generally if they are even, like during the interim, if they're on the phone, their vote generally counts, but I will verify that they will actually be present in attendance to the meeting via video conference.
And we'll be in Ontario, the Dalles,
LeGrand,
Medford, Klamath Falls, and Coos Bay.
Not Cape Falls. Cape Falls doesn't have the facility, okay. But Coos Bay.
Cape Falls would have OIT.
Well, we tried the community college.
Oh, try OIT.
You want Cape? Well, we.
You have a six?
No, I only have the five at this time. But we'll check with OIT.
Yeah, I think OIT was the one that was.
Okay. Okay. For Cape Falls.
For Cape Falls, right.
Great.
So it's real-time television.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think that is what was used before. Okay. Representative Cannon, to help your time schedule, well, you're hanging out in Central Oregon anyway tonight, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we'll open a work session on HB 2213, and you and Representative Richardson have been a part of the work group, perhaps you would like to start off the discussion, and perhaps Representative Richardson can follow. We have some amendments in front of us. The one that I intend to work on today is the Dash 5.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Chair. I have those amendments in front of me, and I would be happy to spend just a minute talking about the process, and if you'd like to go through the amendments or perhaps ask Dorio, I don't know what you had intended, but I'd be happy to go through the Dash 5,
or
leave that to someone else.
No, I'd appreciate if you would go through them, and then we'll invite some other folks to come and comment in a bit.
Okay. Well, let me say just a few words about the process. This was a work group appointed by the chair that met six times over 3 weeks for a total of 9 hours, and included from the insurers, from the hospitals, from the doctors, nurses associations, consumer advocates, Representative Richardson, and myself. I worked very cooperatively, very productively, sort of focused on a common goal, which was to develop a set of amendments to House Bill 2213 that would provide greater transparency for the consumer in this and their process of receiving care and eventually bills from hospitals and insurance companies. So I want to thank the participation, the participants in that for their very good work. We reached consensus, or very near consensus, on every major point, and the Dash 5 amendments that the committee should have reflect very, very closely what the work group talked about. This is a pretty simple concept that is really designed to give consumers the very easy and evident way of determining what their out-of-pocket costs were going to be for service or treatment before they go in and receive that service or treatment. So this bill, if we adopt these amendments and pass this bill, it will require insurance companies to set up methods, primarily via the web, to tell consumers what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be. I'd be happy now to walk through the Dash 5. It's just pretty straightforward. It shouldn't take more than a couple of minutes. Chair, would you like me to proceed with that?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, so if you're looking at the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2213, and this is essentially a complete cutting stuff, so this replaces just about the entirety of the original House Bill 2213. Section 1, of course, is a definition section that distinguishes between in-network services and out-of-network services. Section 2 goes on to describe for in-network services what the insurer is required to provide. And Section 2 sub 1 includes the inputs that the consumer who's using this service is required to give, and that's what you see in the A through D at the bottom of page 1 of the Dash 5 amendments. So the consumer will type in the procedure that they're undergoing, the name of the provider, their policy number, and perhaps the site where that procedure or service will be performed. And then in sub 2, you find that the insurer is required to tell very simply the out-of-pocket costs, including the deductible, the amount of deductible that's been met already, coinsurance, copay, or other cost share, and any applicable benefit maximum. We had a lot of conversation in work group about just what types of services or treatments this requirement would be applied to. And the carriers worked closely, their technical people, along with the doctors and hospitals, to develop a list of mostly routine services that the insurers could provide a reasonable estimate of costs before treatment. And those are listed in the sub 3, A through G. And in fact, the insurer is required to provide out of that reasonable estimate for the 5 most common procedures or services within each of those 7 categories that you see listed there. There are some disclosures listed in the sub 4.
Representative Cannon, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is it, and I would like to put on the record, it's not the assumption that this is ultimately all that this will cover under this program. Is that right, that this would be expanded as time goes on?
Yeah, that's a very important point. You know, we've heard from the insurance companies that many of them are already moving in this direction. And I think they would like to regard this as sort of the baseline. They're very interested in providing better customer service, giving the patient, the consumer, more skin in the game, I think the expression goes. And this is really a starting place for what they are ultimately capable of doing, and I think by and large interested in doing. So what we have are really the basics here, these categories that include routine care and then the 5 most common procedures or services. I think we as a work group were reluctant to go much beyond that, if only because the data can become a little bit more difficult to find, the coding becomes more complex, so we decided to start with what seemed reasonable and possible, knowing that and hoping that the market would help drive additional additional information from the insurers, and then if it doesn't, if there will be the opportunity for the legislature to come back and look at these categories and say, do we need to expand this?
Hold on a minute, Representative. Okay. Representative Gelzer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a question on that same category, and I was just wondering for clarification on the record, knowing that this may be expanded. Under the list of that five most common routine procedures was a normal vaginal delivery, and I wish that cesarean sections weren't routine, but they are for many women. Over a quarter, too routine. I would agree. I mean, had a couple myself. But you know, over a quarter of deliveries end up being cesarean sections. Is there a reason that is excluded?
Representative Gelzer, Chair Greenlink, I am not probably best qualified to answer why cesarean sections are not included as a separate category on here. My guess would be that it's more difficult to give an estimate of cost or a reasonable estimate that the prices vary more widely than is the case under a normal vaginal delivery, but the carriers would be better placed to respond to that question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I was curious about the same thing, why skeletal muscle surgery rather than gastro or something else. I mean, I assume there must have been some logic in there.
Yeah, and Representative Richardson should feel free to chime in here, too, if he has a better recollection than I do of how some of these decisions were made. I know we were, in general, looking for sort of broad categories of common services. And Representative Richardson, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yes. My recollection is the discussion centered around what can be done at this time that is not going to have unintended consequences and challenges. And so as we were discussing what areas would people really have a need for anticipatory ideas on cost, one was childbirth. And while some people do plan on having C-section, quite often they want to know what's it going to cost for a normal direct delivery. The insurance representatives were saying these items, as we discussed here, in fact, we even had dental on here, and then that came off. These were things that they have the information. We want to be able to, they wanted to present it, have a, get the structure, show how it works, be able to do drop-down schedules for them, and then, was, as you notice, it also added to this section is subsection 6, which says this section does not prohibit an insurer from providing information in addition to or in more detail than the information required by the section. The insurance carriers were saying that they would like to have the freedom to expand this, and if they're not moving fast enough, the legislature can come and tell them, but they didn't feel comfortable having an agency have complete control over telling them when they weren't doing enough. So we thought, why don't we get it started? Let's see how it works, and then we can expand it.
Great. You want to go on, Representative Campbell?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to thank you, Representative Richardson, and also for pointing out that subsection 6. We really do hope that the carriers will voluntarily or via sort of market pressures go beyond this, and nothing in here prohibits them from doing that. Subsection 5, just to draw it, well, subsection 4 includes some of the declarations or disclosures that the insurer's estimate must include. And this was important to the carriers in part because they really do want the consumers to know that this is an estimate that things can happen over the course of a treatment or of a service that will expand the cost. You want to make that very clear to patients that although it's an estimate, there are those sort of outlier cases where additional costs may be incurred. There are some other reasons why in an individual case that reasonable estimate may be different than what is actually billed. There is a requirement that the insurers let the patient know that they have some recourse or at least have advocates in the Department of Consumer and Business Services if they do find that there's a major difference between what they were told to expect and what they actually pay. There are some folks who can help explore why that might be the case and take action if it's unreasonable. That about covers section 2. As you see there, subsection 5 at the top of page 3, that this information is it should be available via the web and a toll-free telephone number. Section 3 is essentially mirrors Section 2. It's largely the same, so I will point out only a couple of the, I will point out the differences. Section 3 pertains to the out-of-network care. So this is when the patient decides to go out of their network, it becomes a little bit more complicated for insurers to estimate costs, and that we had to write it somewhat differently. But the point is still the same, that the patient should find out before treatment from their insurer what a reasonable estimate of what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be. They have to provide one additional piece of information that's pretty important. I want to draw your attention to it in line 23 on page 3, and that is the patient is required to provide the provider's billed charge amount. So in addition to here's the service that I'm about to undergo, here's who's going to give it to me, here's my policy number, here's where it will be performed, here's how much they told me they charge for this. And we are hoping that, you know, this will begin the conversation between patients and their providers about cost of care and, you know, various options there. The insurance company then is required to provide basically the same information, out-of-pocket costs broken down in particular ways. They are also required to they are also required to provide, and you see it in on page 4 in line 2, the difference between the insurer's allowable charge and the billed charge for the procedure or service. So this is an additional piece of information that the insurance company is required to provide to the patient. What we learned, and I'm sure many of you know, is that insurance companies, when you go out of network, will not necessarily pay the full bill charge or even relate their payment to the full bill charge, but rather will relate it to an allowable charge that they have determined. And we wanted it to be really clear to patients that there are cases, and in fact it's quite common when you go out of network, that what the 30% cost share is 30% of an allowable charge, not the actual billed charge. So that's the reason for E or line 2 on page 4.
But it's the enrollee that's providing the billed charge, right?
It is the enrollee that's providing the billed charge, but then the insurer is required to say, okay, the billed charge was $100, but our allowable charge for that for particular treatment is only $70. If your cost share is 50%, then you owe 35.
I got it.
Line F, or sub F there, line 4 on page 4, requires the insurer to disclose their average payment or allowable charge for that same procedure or service if it was performed in network. So this gives an additional tool for the consumer to make a comparison between going in network and out of network, seeing how insurers, what they pay for in network versus out of network based on their different contractual arrangements or their computation of allowed charges. So those are the primary differences in how this will work for the consumer when they go out of network. The carriers, the insurers are required to provide that information for the same set of categories for procedures or services, which is there in subsection 3. Subsection 4 includes the same disclosure.
Section 4, right?
Sorry, section 4. Well, no, I'm still looking on page 4.
Okay.
At line 16, and the disclosures there that the insurer is required to make, that other services may be provided that are medically necessary, the enrollee may be responsible for those costs, the number for calling DCVS, et cetera, and I believe those mirror Section 3 or Section 2 exactly. Section 4 is a, quickly here, yes. This is this relates to the DCDS's sort of oversight and approval authority, regulatory authority via the insurers. And essentially, this section requires the insurers to submit for approval to DCDS a explanation of the methodology that they have used to compute or develop their allowable charges for out-of-network procedures or services. In many cases, we understand that the insurers use a third-party vendor to determine what those charges, those allowable charges, will be, and if so, DCDS has asked for the authority to understand, to get an explanation of what their methodology for developing those allowable charges will be. They are, in addition, required to provide for approval the explanation that they will give to enrollees or groups or employers of that same methodology. So a very basic explanation of the methodology they've used to confuse, develop those allowable charges. I want to sort of flag those points A and point B. My understanding is that there is some concern on the part of the carriers about their proprietary rights here, and that they are disinclined to go very far in terms of what they, how far they allow DCDS to sort of peer into their methodology. So there is some concern on their part about the authority that we are giving in Sections A and Section B. Sub A and Sub B. I would say that this did come out of the work group. It was a consensus product of the work group, and I think the understanding there is that not that DCBS would be sort of looking deeply into the inner workings of those methodologies, but would require and need to approve an explanation of that methodology. So that's Section 4 sub A and B. There's additional regulatory authority provided in sub C, and that allows them to measure the effect of these disclosure requirements. And there is the provision in Section 4 sub 2 that the director shall consider the recommendations of a health insurance reform advisory committee in prescribing what information is required for submission. This is an advisory body that includes representatives of the insurance companies, and they did ask that we include this subsection in Section 4. Any questions there, or should I move on to Section 5? I'll go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hearing none. Section 5 allows basically some flexibility in this process. Director of DCBS can waive these requirements and allow insurers to use alternative disclosure mechanisms, assuming that if and in fact it's the case that they get, pretty much to the same place. So this has some built-in flexibility. If a particular carrier decides to take this above and beyond, or a slightly different set of categories of services or treatments, that would be permissible if the director of DCBS deems it so, and decides a rule that is substantively similar. Section 6 is the rulemaking authority, and Section 7 is the effective date of January 1, 2009. There was a fair amount of discussion about what this effective date should be. Some of us sort of like to see this sooner. The carriers assured us that they are working on this, but it's going to take them some time, at least in the cases of some insurance companies, to get there. this January 1, 2009 seemed like a reasonable middle ground between where the consumer advocates would like them to be and where the carriers think they can reasonably get. So I, of course, would be happy to talk about this to the extent that the chair would like.
Well, I'll ask Representative Richardson for additional comments, and then I know Representative Moore has a question.
Okay, let me. I'd like to step back to the beginning because some of the committee members haven't been as closely involved with this process as Representative Cannon and I have. And I'd like to just say that the members that were attending this work group, it was a very effective, very experienced group. Everybody worked well together, and this is a very difficult challenge. I mean, the relating clause says relating to payments for procedures covered by health benefit plans. And the explanation says requires insurers offering benefits to disclose upon request of enrollees anticipated costs to enrollee a prescribed procedure or service. Easy to put down, tough to make happen. I mean, let's take a look at, we've got normal vaginal childbirth, all right? My wife and I, her first childbirth, unexpectedly, were twins. I didn't know it until we got to the hospital.
They charged twice as much?
I don't remember. I just paid payments until they got out of college. But it was a bit of a challenge. But she also had a natural. So there's no epidural. Was there an episiotomy or not? I'm not sure. So what do you do when you're trying to estimate what is a normal vaginal delivery, and does it include episiotomy, epidural? How about oxytocin? How about how long are they going to be in there? What if there's all these variables, you see. And so for this to actually function, it's going to be a bit of a challenge because the person says, hey, we're just going to have a baby. How much is it going to cost? You know? Say, well, how you doing? You know what's your health like? And so this whole process is kind of fluid. And so the insurance carriers are a little bit concerned because they don't want to be held accountable for failing to give good advice. But on the other hand, if they give 30 variables, then it's of no value at all. The doctor's a little concerned because they're saying, well, you know, what are you going to do? Give an estimate of what we charged in the past? No, well, if you're out of network, what we'll do is have somebody ask the doc, what's it going to cost? So now the doc's going to say, well, are you going to have twins or are you going to have single? Are you going to have an epidural? You see, they have to do the same thing. So they're in the same position because nobody wants to be tied down to say it's going to cost 35 to 6 grand or whatever the number is because nobody really knows. And yet the assignment is to do something. And so the insurance carriers, the larger ones, are already along this, but they're dealing with their own insurance. You know, you want to know, you say, well, what kind of plan you've got? Okay, what's your deductible? Here's a coinsurance. If you're doing it in panel, it's not so bad because we got deals with docs, and we know basically what it's going to cost. When it's out of panel, now, you know, we pay 80% up to $50 on this procedure, but if you add this, then it's something else. You see, it's really a challenge. And so what is coming to this full committee is the best that we believe we can work out at this time because it's limited in scope, but rightly so, because we don't know what we're getting into or what kind of adjustments you're going to have to make. And it's a whole lot easier to make adjustments on 5 or 6 starting out categories than if we said, okay, we want all of the numbers, you know, in HIPAA or whatever. And so we don't want to bite off more than we can chew, but it's easier to adjust and make course corrections when you start off with a fairly small universe. So anyway, I fully support the amendments. I think that everyone has worked very hard to come up with what we have here. We've had to give some flexibility, but the major insurance carriers will comply very quickly, but there may be some that are just not as far along, and they don't want to be penalized or be held in, you know, failure to comply because they haven't got the staff or the ability or the money to move as quickly as Regents does or something like that. So anyway, I fully support the bill and its this amendment to the bill.
Great. Representative Maher?
Yes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. My questions are back to a different example than the normal vaginal delivery. It's just your normal office call. And that the complexities, even at that level, it's not, you know, you don't go into the office and say, well, you know, and you can put a price tag on this, which
like
I hope
is... $25 visit, please.
I hope this is less than $10. But the reality is that the cost is not based on some tangible product that the patient can see, it's based on essentially medical complexity. And when you go from a $40 to a $300 office visit, that's a pretty wide range. When you tell them ahead of time, you're coming in for a normal office visit, you're going to pay, maybe $50, $75. When they walk out the door, it may be $300. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge when they go to the website and say, well, golly, it says it's only $50. And it's not $50. Who's responsible for that? And that's a question I have. Who's responsible for that if the estimate is wrong? Without going through an entire process to go back and justify this to your patient, which you're going to have to do when they make a complaint. I applaud the effort, but I just think that it's wrought with problems along the way. And the other issue is it's tough enough to do it in network. You start dealing out of network, and you open up a completely different can of worms. And it's just, you can have a disclaimer that says, patient, this is not what you may actually be charged. As long as the providers are covered at some level, let alone the insurance company, but the providers, that they're not going to get hammered because the information was wrong, because the person thought they had strep throat, and come to find out they've got pneumonia. And then they've got, something else that's following. So
the out-of-network thing is a slightly different process, because it requires the patient producing what the provider said is the billed charge. So, I mean, it looks to me like the out-of-network is going to be a post-facto rather than a prior visit.
How about very post-facto?
Well,
30, 45 days post-facto before they're going to get their billed charge.
President Cannon, you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think it was our intent and certainly our hope that at least for some set of procedures and services, the consumer would be able to get from the provider some estimate at least of the cost of service or treatment. Obviously, this becomes difficult, if not impossible, for certain kinds of medical conditions. But is it really, I almost asked this as a question, and perhaps for Representative Maurer, is it truly unreasonable for me to call a doctor and expect to know what it's going to cost for me to get a routine checkup for strep throat and what the bill charge on that is, knowing that if it's something else entirely, yes, the costs are going to escalate. But it, our assumption, and I didn't hear a lot of pushback on this from the doctors or the hospitals, was that you can in fact get some idea of what the billed charge is going to be before service or treatment, at least for some range of routine procedures.
Well, certainly for certain of these, I think the diagnostic ones you probably can, but when you're talking about skeletal muscle surgery, there's no way you're going to get billed charges in advance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The far left of the table here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. is anybody else doing this or anything similar to this, or are we blazing a new trail here?
I think in terms of state authority, we're blazing a new trail. There are people doing this. There are insurance companies doing this, including in Oregon. But in terms of putting it into the statute, we're blazing a new trail.
Thank you.
That's why I expect that's why we're cautious about how many different procedures we're talking about and giving enough time to make it happen. I'm sure the carriers would have rather had 2023, but 2009 will work.
Yes. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Is it possible in this bill to look at if this just ends up not being workable as it's written, to have a sunset of 2012 or something, so that there's a point at which this blows up? Because if it works, and if it works as it's written, then great, we drive on. But otherwise, if this is just not the direction that is going to work, then maybe it needs to have a point at which it just...
That's possible. My assumption is if it doesn't work, we're going to hear about it very quickly.
And Mr. Chair, I want to echo what you just said, which is that it is working already. We saw, Representative Richardson, I believe, also, and I both saw examples of, or an example of an insurance company that's able to do most of this already. And I suspect they're not the only one. This is certainly the direction that at least some of the major carriers already are moving.
Before we go too much further, let me bring a couple of folks up. Please, Mr. Ariel, and I know Scott Gallant has a comment he wants to make, and I want to put something on the record about OMA's objection at this point. How about somebody from one of the carriers coming up? Somebody representing the carriers.
Mr. Chair,
do you have a comment to start?
Sure. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just a couple comments. First, to commend, as you saw from the summary there, Representative Cannon has a total grasp of the issues that we worked through here, and Representative Richardson as well. We were well led on this process, and I think we came with a very good work product, and I think the discussion today reflects a much higher level of understanding both of what needs to happen and some of the complexity that means that we have to go cautiously and in slow steps on the process. I'll make just four basic comments. The first is, as the chair suggested, this is just a starting point. Nobody thinks that healthcare pricing is going to be like the grocery store anytime soon, where you pick it off the shelf and you go to the checkout counter, it's exactly the same price and so forth. It's not going to work like that. But we want it to work at least like home remodeling. I'm in the middle of one of those processes right now, and my wife is taking the lead on it, and we've got.
It can be better than that.
Well, I hope it can be better, but for a while it may be about like that. And the process is this: with my wife has got us down to two contractors now, and we're trying to get an estimate, a final estimate, to decide which of them we're going to go with. And they're deathly resisting us. Well, we can tell you, it's too complicated. It all depends on this and that. And I'm saying to my wife, before we start, I want a piece of paper on which to say, here's what we plan to do now based on what you've asked, and here's the price we estimate. It's going to have all the qualifications this process has. But you know what? If I get that estimate, I have no illusion that it's likely to end up that way. In fact, everybody I talk to kind of has your reaction, which is, oh, my God, it'll be way two or three times what it starts with. But at least I'll have a starting point, and when it changes, I will ask questions. Well, why was that estimate not right? What was the new thing? Does that make sense? Is it fair? And so forth. So that's really, I think, all we're doing here is getting a starting estimate. And if you look at the page that we handed out that has the two charts on it, the numbers for in-network aren't that complicated. You just start with the billed charge that the company knows. It's the negotiated rate that they're going to pay, and then you have their share and the patient's share, the patient's out-of-pocket share. So I think you can get those numbers as an estimate. The complexity comes, as Representative Richardson said, when they quote you for a particular procedure, and then there are several things that are added on in the process. So that's where I think the complexity comes. The out-of-network situation is more complicated. We recognize that. I think the letter from Mr. Gallant does expose a lot of the complexity here. To my mind, we pretty much recognize that in the bill, in language that was actually drafted by his legal counsel, which is on page 2 of the bill, lines 21.
Page 2 of the dash 5?
Page 2 of the dash 5s, I'm sorry. It's lines 21 to 25. That's the first kind of qualification that always would be offered. That other services may be provided to the enrollee that are medically necessary and appropriate as part of the common procedures. These will be the ones that would be estimated, of which the insurer or enrollee may not be aware at the time of the inquiry and for which the enrollee may have additional financial responsibility. That's why I go to remodeling. There's always, we didn't think about X and Y. There's going to be that kind of situation, and I think that's what that language is designed to say, is there is complexity, but let's not have the enemy, the perfect, be the enemy of the good. The other two points I'd make starting out are, one, when we try to regulate in an area where we're regulating against the interest of the insurance industry, say we're trying to limit risk selection in the healthcare marketplace, then everything has to be very carefully defined in the statutes because everybody's going to look for the loopholes and try to get around it. This is the opposite kind of issue. This is what the companies are trying to do already themselves anyway, and all we're trying to do with this law is goad along everybody to meet certain minimum standards. But they all have incentives. Nobody wants to say to their consumer, yes, I just up here cost sharing, and yes, you have to have more skin in the game, but no, I can't tell you a single thing about what it will actually cost you to do anything with my company. They all feel under the gun to answer that question. They all want to. So all we're doing here is laying minimum expectations that we expect the companies to move well beyond. The last two comments are the alternative disclosures. I think that Representative Cannon noted in on page 5 in section 5 are very important. We've had discussion where if these particular ways of doing it are superseded by new approaches that are better than this, we have the authority under this law to say if it gives the consumer more information than this, so be it. That's good. We don't. This is a bare minimum. If you can do it better, go further, we're for it. And then the last comment is, and I think this is very important, we do want this information under the bill to be out before the person incurs the cost. And that's why on page 3, line 5, we talk about an interactive website where you get the information immediately. And all of these cases, somebody produces a bill, as Representative Maurer says, after the fact. I mean, in every one of these cases, somebody does get paid. So they figure out how much it did cost and who's got what share of it. We want that information earlier, and we want it through an interactive website. And I do believe under this bill, and I think it does relate to some of the OMA's concerns, there will be more questions for providers early on these out-of-network situations. I'd like to figure out which one I'm going to go to, and I'd like to know what your bill charge is, and I think that's good market pressure to have. I think that people ought to be able to ask their doctors or their insurance companies, you know, for the price. And this idea that today you call up the hospital and you ask, what's this cost? And the answer is, well, tell me who your insurer is, and, you know, it's all complicated. We want to get it simpler, and we want to put market pressure on people to answer. I believe this bill will accomplish that. I'm happy to answer other questions, but you may want to hear other comments first.
There are some questions. I wanted to ask you one question first. Do you think there's going to be a fiscal on this?
Mr. Chair,
dash-fives?
No, we believe not. I mean, it's a relatively straightforward rulemaking process for us, we believe.
Representative Gelsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You kind of touched on the question that I have, and I haven't seen Mr. Gallant's letter yet or testimony yet. But if all of this is based upon the consumer providing to you the cost of the service that's there, how is it different than what's already available? I can go to my insurance policy, and it tells me that they pay 80% out. This actually is very similar to my plan, 80% in-network, 20% out. How I could get out a calculator and figure that out if I called my doctor and was actually able to find out what the cost was. How will this help consumers be able to get a physician to tell them what the cost of an orthopedic surgery might be, or what the cost of a vaginal delivery might be, or what the hospital costs? Would a consumer on that normal vaginal delivery, for example, in order to get this back, will they need to call the physician, the anesthesiologist, if there's an epidural, the hospital, in order to get all of those charges to give to the insurance company to do this mathematical computation for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, all very good questions. On the in-network side, it's simpler. And so I think on that side, there is a real gain here, which is today, I don't know about your health plan, but I have a hard time calling up and saying, or going to a website, much less at the time when it's convenient to me, and saying, I'm going to go have this kind of hospital visit, take a doctor visit for a strep throat, or I'm going to have a prostate check or whatever, and punch in numbers and find out exactly what that costs. I don't know about those things today. There isn't an easy mechanism to get them. So I do believe on the in-network side, the carriers want to provide this. They're moving this way. Some of them have this technology about ready to roll out in certain types of situations. And I think there's a real gain, because I don't think today most people, even on their basic in-network procedures, can get a simple answer to the question of, assume that I'm only asking for this kind of service. I understand there may be complexity, but if I don't have any of those complications, what would be the cost? Give me an estimate today. So I think there's a gain. On the out-of-network side, if you have more simple procedures. There will be good disclosure here, too. But I believe you're right to say that the bill charge situation, if you're talking about a complicated surgery that does involve, you know, a number of different providers, this bill by itself isn't going to solve that kind of situation. It will solve more simple situations. Once the carriers start doing the kind of things that are in this bill, I believe the more complicated situations will be worked on as well. I mean, what we get here, for instance, on every service, if you go in and do a website and say, this is the kind of service I want, there will be a drop-down menu which will say, well, which, you say office visit, which of these 10 types of office visits are you asking for? And then if you hit number 3, it'll be, well, are you talking about just this number 3, or are you talking about these 4 things that go with it? There'll be all of those kinds of questions. That's what consumers need to get educated about and be able to understand to get the system more effective for them.
I think we need to move along. One of the committee members wants to get up expeditiously today, right?
I know. I just, my question didn't get answered. I'm the committee member that wants to, so I understand. I guess what I don't understand is that it's when an enrollee or an enrollee's authorized representative. So even on that in-network cost, in my health insurance plan, it tells me what my copay is and what my insurance's portion is. So if my doctor tells me if I come in for a strep throat exam and it's $79. If I have a calculator, I can figure that out. I guess I'm wondering what I'm missing, why there needs to be a website to do that for me, and why I wouldn't use my calculator to if I'm able to get what the actual cost is.
You don't need that for in that network.
You don't, okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I'm sorry, I missed the question that way. In the in-network side, the bill charge is provided by the insurer. That's
okay.
The whole issue.
All right, got it.
Tell me
right.
How much, because it's not really, the bill charge is not the correct term there. It actually should have been the contracted rate.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know not what the hospital will charge me if I'm walking in off the street. I want to know what the insurer is going to pay under their contract, and then I calculate my copay. But you're right, if you get the contracted rate, if you read your contract, yes, you could calculate your copay. Although, if you read these contracts, you might be confused as to exactly what copay applies and how much of your deductible you've spent. All of that is covered in the bill, too.
Okay, thank you very much.
Scott, do you want to have
One last question, Mr. Chair. And what would you expect would happen to an insurer that didn't comply by January 1st, 2009?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, typically we're flexible with people if they have good reasons for missing deadlines. In fact, I'd say more than half the time deadlines get extended for good cause. Ultimately, our authority here is the same as it is on any other violation of the insurance code, which is the ability to assess civil penalties up to $10,000 per violation. So we have plenty of authority if we need to use it, but rarely do we use that kind of hammer over an implementation question, as long as it's in good faith.
You're hanging from the yard.
Their consumers will migrate to other companies.
Is that Florence?
Well, I do have a question, but if you're trying to expedite so that Representative Cannon can get it off the phone, I can wait till later.
I don't mind Representative Cannon hanging on the telephone.
No, I thought you were trying to facilitate his being able to move into Central Oregon, wherever he is. The 5 common practices that are shown on page 2, now there's a significant difference between an office visit and perhaps an x-ray and an orthopedic musculoskeletal surgery. And that seems to provide, for other medical necessities such as an anesthesiologist and, you know, on and on and on. So is it such a routine procedure that that's considered?
It's 5 inside each of those categories.
So in, for instance, the surgery.
Oh.
It's the 5 most common things that would happen under that.
So it would be the anesthesiologist, the surgeon,
the
nurse, the operating room, and so on?
Yeah. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Floyd, I think probably the Nancy Nevins from LifeWise would be the best person to answer in the detail of that.
Sue, if you introduce yourself.
Yes. For the record, I'm Nancy Nevins with LifeWise Health Plan, and I was a member of the work committee, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to participate. It was a very interesting and collaborative process. So your question was regarding the categories. and it would be the five most frequent categories under orthopedic musculoskeletal surgery. So that could be knee surgeries, it could be an ankle surgery, it could be a back surgery, and it's each plan's most common. So it is driven towards your own membership's most frequent surgeries within that category. So if I was going in there and my doctor said, oh, you know, you've got a bum knee, we're going to have to do a procedure on you, and we're going to have to do an ACL repair, I would go in and I could look to see if an ACL repair was on there. And then if I found it, it would also have a whole bunch, because there's, it's never just that. There's always some categories with it. And the way we envision it working, that you'd be probably getting the information from your provider, and you would be opening a dialogue and working through this information together. And then the doctor would say, well, this is the one we think you're going to have. And you would be able to put the information in there and see what your cost share would be for those surgeries. What it wouldn't do is tell you what your additional ancillary services would be. For example, radiology, pathology, anesthesiologists, but we would have information regarding that there could be additional charges, and that would also open the dialogue for saying, okay, what else is this going to, am I going to have performed, and how much is it going to cost me? So you can work and open the dialogue to find out that information. Does that help?
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Nancy. It does help.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a range of fields, and we're talking about a range of costs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I understand the whole focus is to try to narrow it so that a consumer will know what those costs are and perhaps ultimately control some of the higher costs that are out there. But with a variant field of costs in any of those areas, that mm-hmm. how does a person get a handle on what they might be looking at?
I think for the start of this, it's going to create a dialogue between the member and the provider service regarding what are the possible, as Representative Richardson discussed, regarding, you're going to go have a baby. And it's like, under the category for normal delivery, there is a range of activities that can occur to you. And it brings open the discussion with the provider regarding what types of costs could I be, in line for. Because a lot of people don't know when they're going to be going to have a baby that they're going to get all these additional fees. A classic example is that if I go inpatient for service and I'm going to have x-ray, that I will get a charge for the service of reading the x-ray as well as for the x-ray itself. It will start creating dialogue for those situations to educate consumers regarding those potentials. Most people haven't been sick, thankfully, but this is part of the education process when one does have to entertain these types of services. Some of the questions to start asking and getting answers for, in order you can make decisions regarding, do I want to go down this road or do I want to go down this road, and what is going to be my financial obligation.
Thank you. Do you have any other comments you want to add about
this? I wanted to just address.
Mr. Chair, there's something that I've been asked to put on the record by the carriers, and Representative Cannon alluded to it. If you look at the language on page, I believe it's page 5, line 11, where it says, for approval, the methodology used to determine the insurer's allowable charges, or if the insurer uses a third party to determine the charges, the methodology used by the third party. It's been pointed out to us that in some cases there may be multiple third parties, and then, for instance, in the Blue Cross network, there may be 20 or 30 different Blues plans which occasionally come into play as a third with their own methodologies for out of network across the country. It is not our intent to require filing of all of those methodologies, and we had discussed in concept putting the words upon request into this draft, and it neglected to get it into this draft. So we think we can handle that by rule. If we need to correct it on the Senate side or something, we're fine to do it. But the intent here is not to, is to get at the main methodologies and not to request every methodology from somebody who might have incidental use of multiple different methodologies.
Representative
Ma?
One question. Is it Betsy?
Me?
Yes.
Nancy.
It's close.
This morning.
Okay.
Good morning.
excuse me. The question is, do you have an estimate for LifeWise on how much this might cost you over the next couple of years?
Mr. Chair and Representative Maher, we are in the process of, as many carriers, are developing a member cost estimator tool. And it is taking the efforts of many people, a lot of IT resources, and a lot of dedication. And the tool will be available. I don't have the exact dates, but very many of the health plans are actively engaged in the process of developing these types of tools for members, because we're responding to our customers' requests for these types of information and resources to make informed healthcare decisions. So, yeah, we are definitely working on a tool, as well as a number of the carriers.
Actually,
in other words, a lot of money is the answer.
A lot of money, but so regardless of this bill, you are still moving. You would
absolutely
be moving in that direction anyway.
Absolutely.
Does this give you some sideboards on how to do that?
It has put some additional factors into consideration, yes, sure, especially in the out-of-network area.
Mr. Gallen?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Evans. A little slow today.
My peripheral vision's a little bit.
What's driving the industry to do this voluntarily, specifically?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kotek, it's consumer request, member requests for information. It's in recognition of the push towards consumerism. It's in recognition that people are asking questions and need answers in order to make, once again, informed decisions regarding their health care options. It's in recognition of the increasing costs of medical care and how can I be a partner in and have a responsibility for my own choices and decisions regarding my medical care and how I act responsibly regarding my medical care in the future. And it's all those things coming together. There's more discussion now. A lot of it's driven by information that's coming out, studies that are coming out. Employers are engaging us in conversation. What can I give my employees? And HSAs, HRAs, people are asking for these types of tools. And we're in the business of trying to respond to our customers' needs.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add very briefly, if you're in a traditional Kaiser-type plan with very low cost-sharing, flat co-payments, and so forth, you're not going to probably have a lot of interest in these kinds of issues. But if you're in LifeWise's high-deductible plans today, where you've got a lot of, quote, skin in the game, you're going to care a lot about these kind of issues. And there are more of those kind of plans all the time in the marketplace.
Or in Kaiser's point-of-service plan under PEB.
Yes, Kaiser's moving the same way, so...
Well, I appreciate the response, and it's good to see the industry being that responsive.
Thank you.
Scott, do you want to...
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Gallen. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I appreciate the opportunity to make two or three very brief comments. One, as you have seen today, this is exceedingly complex. It gets more complex the more you think about it. And one of our primary concerns of the Medical Association is that physicians are not put in a position where they may not know the service that they will provide because of the illness or degree of injury that a patient has, and a patient becomes angry with them because the difference in their out-of-pocket responsibilities are more than they believe. Particularly since, as you just heard, many of the things that a patient will be obligated for, ancillary services involved with medical care, don't appear to be part of the total mix of this. So, you know, you're really going to have a very crude measurement here. I think we'll get more sophisticated over time. That's one. Two, there have been instances nationally where insurers, it's not happened here, where insurers have made very disparaging remarks regarding out-of-network providers. We had hoped to have had constitutional language to present to the committee that would set some limits on comments about out-of-network services and in-network services. Unfortunately, that didn't work out in time. I have new language, which the chair has not seen, nor has Legislative Council or anyone else, but I believe it's very important that there be further consideration for that as well. The association believes in its policy is that you should have transparency for everyone, and that includes insurers. I understand the concept of business secrets and confidentiality about how calculations are made, but often physicians, whether they are on panels or out-of-panel physicians, they have no idea and cannot access the methodology of what they will, in fact, be paid. And the reason that we insisted on bill charges as the consistent marker is that that is what a physician does know. He or his office rarely can tell you with great certainty what they will, in fact, ultimately be paid for any given service by any given provider over any given period of time. Now, I know that sounds odd, but it is true, and it happens every day. Anyway, I appreciate the opportunity. I think this bill is much improved, but I think there is a much more work to be done in the future. Thank you.
There was some language, let me just put on the record, there was some language that the OMA suggested, the Legislative Council suggested it might not be constitutional under Article 8, under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. My recommendation is that we move this bill, that we commend that language to the Senate, where I think it will be ready and can be improved, and that when the Senate adds it to this bill, we will accept it when it comes back with that language added. Nancy, did you want to say something else?
Yes.
Representative Kotek.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to echo the concerns expressed by Representative Cannon and Joe Ario regarding that some carriers have some concerns regarding the time frame for the implementation date on the January 2009. A lot of people have various products in the pipeline. Some are further down the road than others, and there was a great deal of carrier concern regarding the 1/1/2009 date. So
that is 21 months from now. So
we are
think to have
that.
A fighting chance of getting it.
So thank you very much,
Representative Godet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a helpful first start, but what's interesting to me is this discussion of ancillary services. If I go in and get a knee surgery or something, and I need anesthesia, I don't think that is ancillary. That's core to the surgery. And so I think what's challenging about this is the way we silo how we bill for things when they're really all part of a bundled package of things you need to have the service done. So I think it's a challenge here of trying to pick things off to give us an idea of what they cost when you really do need all those things. But I don't know. It struck me as interesting that we would consider those things as you gotta have to have them. But yeah, that'd be. I'm just curious if you talked about that.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Representative Kotek, and we really I really look at this as a starting point, and hoping that by giving consumers a taste of the kind of information that insurers and their providers can provide, we get the consumer to the place where they're demanding more. And you take ancillary services as one aspect of this. Another is courses of treatment that last longer than a single day or a single sort of procedure. So take diabetes treatment. I mean, I think the really important and useful information for the consumer is what is this going to cost over the course of a month or a year? And that's not information that this bill will really help the consumer get. So I agree with you, Representative, that this is just a start. That we are hoping, and Mr. Ario has spoken to this quite eloquently, I think we are hoping that this helps sort of propel the market to do its job in getting the consumer more information by getting the consumer to the place where they are demanding more information from insurers.
Mr. Chair, just real briefly, if the notion here is to get the second, third, fourth levels of complexity, I would submit to you there's no better strategy to do that than to pass this bill, which will create the questions which will move us to those levels. I think that's absolutely on point.
Representative Richardson?
I have a final comment, and this is in relation to what Mr. Gallant said. I think physicians and providers do have a right to know what's going on as well, and it would be very easy, relatively easy, for there to be a list of the procedures, and then each insurance company would take each procedure and say, we will pay 100% of this procedure, 1.05, 0.98, or whatever, and the docs could look it up and
Tony's
see.
Tony's going to pay 105.
I'm going to sail this week. It's like, get it done now. So the point is that that information could be on the computers, and the docs could go and see what the plan is and know what they're going to get paid. And so this relating clause would actually cover that. It does say relating to payments for procedures covered by the health benefit plan, and knowing how insurance companies like to cooperate, I would just think that we ought to consider that in the Senate side.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a big picture question that I'd like to ask Nancy, but if either of the representatives who were involved in the work group would like to respond as well, I'd appreciate that. I know the goal is more information, and what I'm wondering is what are we expecting the consumers to, what's the primary task that they'll be using or engaging on with this information? Is it to have financial predictability, or is it to shop around, where am I going to get my health care, or is it to make a decision on whether or not to pursue the recommended health care, or a little bit of each?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's a number of things that can come out of this, and those are all part of it. One is where we have to start at the very beginning. There's a lot of people, myself included, at my health plan, I can log in and actually watch my claims get processed, and I have never done it. And quite frankly, nobody can make me. So what we have to do is reach out to all levels of consumers, those who want to be that active in reviewing their health claims and participating in their own health care needs, and to people who are a little bit more passive in that regard that really don't want to mess with it until that particular point in time when they feel compelled to get information and to engage a provider in a conversation. And this is it was useful from not only the standpoint of what is an episode of care going to run me regarding a circumstance of like normal delivery or diabetes, versus I have some very serious issues now for a child, or you know, versus what is it how can I plan for my immunization costs for my children. So it's all those areas that we're looking into, and how can we get information to consumers. Most carriers are actively engaged in customer focus groups where we have gone out and talked to customers and said, you know, is this level of information too much? Is it the right amount? Do you need less? And how do we get them the right information at the right point in time that they find is valuable? And how do we make it flexible enough that they can reach people like me and reach people who are very, very engaged?
I'm gonna interrupt. I think we really need to close this. We have three other bills to deal with. And Representative Kent. Representative Richardson, why don't you move the amendment, and then we'll let Representative Cannon move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -5 amendments to House Bill 2213.
Are there any objections to the -5 amendments to House Bill 2213? -5 amendments are accepted. Representative Cannon, you want to move the bill to the floor with a due process recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2213 as amended by the -5 amendments to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Representative Richardson and Representative Cannon for their hard work on this super complex.
Yes, and I was going to say that I think we're doing something here that really will move the field forward if all works out as it could be. All in favor of this motion, please signify by saying aye. And all
aye.
Opposed,
aye.
Wait a minute. And all opposed, will please say no. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bonney.
Aye.
Representative Berlin.
Aye. Excused.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Belcher. Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kopeck.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye.
The motion passes. Representative Cannon, will you carry it on the floor, please?
Howie.
Are you going to hang around for a bit?
You know, Chair, I'm actually going to go. I'm afraid I'm going to get booted out of these council chambers.
All right.
Thank you very much for calling in. Beautifully sunny over here in Central Oregon, and we spent a wonderful day learning about all the extraordinary things going on in renewable energy in Bennett, and it's a great place to be. So thank you for letting me join you by phone.
Thank you. I'll close the work session on HB 2213 and open a work session on HB 2660 and call Dr. Goldberg for the. And I will tell you, committee, what my intention on this is that we need to take a very forthright position on this bill and move it over to Ways and Means to let them deal with it when we're done hearing what Dr. Goldberg has to say.
Mr. Chair, I believe...
You want to talk about this bill before we do it?
Not necessarily. I don't. I know we're on an expeditious timeline, but I just want to bring to the committee members' attention, you have Bruce's testimony attached to the preliminary SMS that he had for us on Wednesday, and I just included it with your materials, I believe, behind the fiscal impact statement, I think. Aaron, is that right? Okay. Thank you.
Hold on a minute. We're talking about 266 here. There's a fiscal impact statement.
And
behind it
is
Dr. Goldman's testimony. You know the fiscal impact?
Mm-hmm.
There's a modest fiscal impact, right?
Right. Well, define modest.
Under 100 million?
Oh, don't tell me that's the new threshold. We really are in a state of fluid.
100 million here, 100 million there, you know. You see, you're talking about money.
Okay. Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services, having listened to the previous discussion, I can tell you that the good news is we're going to talk about an issue about health benefits. It's going to be easy, and I can tell you exactly what it costs. This is really an issue about the fact that 2 years ago, the legislature asked the Department of Human Services to make some changes in benefits in the Oregon Health Plan. The 05 Legislative Assembly asked us to make some changes. We went to CMS to ask permission to make those changes, as we always do. It took quite a bit of time for them to come around and provide us with that approval. We're now a year and a half later, and I would say that the reason that the changes were mandated was because at that point there was a budget crisis. We're a year and a half further into the future, and actually only a few months left in the biennium. And what this bill would do would be to have us not make those changes. We have yet to make these benefit reductions. The benefit reductions would only be made for a couple of months, and then they would be restored. And so what this bill does is have us not make those benefit reductions, because we are required by law to do that, and instead, I believe, allow the legislature through the Ways and Means process to figure out what is sort of your purview in terms of the next several years and what would be in the budget. So let me now, with that as an introduction, back up, because this gets complicated, although I said it was easy. We were asked by the legislature to make four benefit cuts, which were eliminating routine vision care for non-pregnant adults on the Oregon Health Plan, limiting over-the-counter drugs for OHP Plus and OHP Standard, limiting dental restorations for individuals, adults in OHP Plus, and limiting inpatient hospital coverage to 18 days. After someone had been in the hospital for more than 18 days cumulatively, the department would not pay hospitals for the services rendered. So these were put in our budget in 05, and put into statute House Bill 3108, which mandated the department to seek permission from the federal government to make these changes, and then if we got that approval, to go ahead and carry out those changes. The bill, however, and I think the important piece here is that the reductions sunset at the end of this biennium. So these benefit cuts, which we are about to make, because we're required to by law, will by law sunset at the end of the biennium. In other words, they'll come back. So what this bill does is it repeals the section of House Bill 3108 that requires us to make those benefit cuts. And if this were passed, we would not implement those benefit cuts for the rest of the biennium. And let me stop there and answer any questions.
The earliest you could do it would be for May 1st right now. Right?
Yes.
Yes, please. Mr. Chair, Mr. Goldberg, Director Goldberg, am I correct that this has an effect on providers? I mean, they have to change codes in their computers and those kinds of things. I mean, it's not just something that is easy done, and then they're going to change them back in 2 months, and then people have them. Maybe they don't have the benefit, and they're coming back anyway. Can DHS function all right if this bill goes on through?
Vice Chair Richardson and Chair Greenlick, indeed, you're correct. I mean, this requires a tremendous amount of administrative work, which the department has been doing. That's why I thought one of the questions would be, you got approval in September, how come you haven't made the cuts yet? And part of that answer is it takes many months to do a lot of the work in terms of renegotiating contracts, figuring out rates, giving clients the appropriate notice, etc. It's a tremendous amount of administrative work for the department. It's also a lot of administrative work for our partners, doctors and health plans who would need to, particularly the managed care plans that would need to reprogram their systems to be able to deal with these benefit changes. And then if they come back 2 or 3 months later, it is a tremendous amount of administrative expense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I clarify what would be difficult for the department would be if we did not pass this bill? That would be the concern, because you have not yet implemented the changes. So the difficulty for the department would be, if we don't change it, you have to implement now, which means you would cut people off for 2 months just to add them back on July 1st.
Right. Representative Gelser, Chair Greenlick, that's correct. I think the issue here is it's really not just a difficulty for the department. It's also, this is an issue for the department. It's an issue for our clients and an issue for our providers. And it's really an issue, to me, of consistency and stability. And what we've seen over the last several years has been a situation where we've had benefits cut, restored, cut, and restored. It creates a lot of confusion. It seems to me that, and I will sort of editorialize for a moment, that you know the appropriate place to deal with this is in the Ways and Means process, where I believe the legislature can actually decide whether or not to do this for the next several years, but to wait until that happens, because otherwise we may be in the position of making a decision now that a month later is overturned.
There is no vehicle to do it in the future at the moment.
No, there is not. That's correct.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Okay. So I guess I have a question about the statutory requirement. What if this moves to the Ways and Means process and sits there as the budget continues to be negotiated, what is your legal protection to not implement what's currently in statute? So that if we don't pass this now because it goes to Ways and Means, how do you accomplish not implementing the cuts? Do you understand the question?
Representative Gelser, Chair Greenlick, I understand that very well. I'd need to refer this to the Department of Justice for a sense of what the legal protection is, but I would say that, you know, we are continuing to work to make these cuts because we have to and we abide by the law.
We have to have a letter out. In order to do it even on May 1st, you have to have a letter out before April 1st.
Right. We need to give our clients at least 30 days' notice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fall of, I guess it was 05, the Medicaid Advisory Committee was approached by the department to deal with some of these cut issues. And, you know, I'm actually happy to see this because I think House Bill 3108, by passing the buck to the department to implement these cuts, was not the right thing to do at the end of the last session. So, you know, and I know you've worked very hard not only to get CMS approval, to get community input on what cuts to make and to actually try to implement them. So this timeline is just, that's what's happened, and I'm actually very happy to see this bill. So thank you for testifying today.
Are you ready to put a motion on the floor to
Mr. Chair?
Move this to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation?
Is there any more comment?
Oh, we can have discussion after this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill 2660 with a due pass recommendation. Is it due pass or just...
It can be due pass or no recommendation at all. Either are options.
Well, that is your option.
Well, I'd like to recommend a due pass.
I would suggest due pass.
Recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee.
Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair. So I wanted to clarify the point of my question. I'm also very pleased that we're hearing this bill. My only concern is if it goes to Ways and Means that, I mean, do... Is
it
there
has
any,
to go to Ways and Means.
Right. I know it has to go to Ways and Means, but is there anything functionally that the legislature can do to keep you from having to move forward with the expense of making the reductions and creating that level of uncertainty among your providers and your clients?
Representative Gelser, Chair Greenlick, I think that certainly by considering this bill and if you were to pass this bill, it would be, I believe, at least I would take that as an indication of some degree of legislative willingness to consider this and move this along, and certainly that would be something that we would need to consider.
Happy any other discussion? All right. We have a motion on the floor. All in favor of the motion, please say aye when the roll call is taken. Those opposed, say no. And the committee assistant, please call the roll.
Representative Bruin.
Aye. Excused.
Representative Cannon.
Excuse.
Representative
Gelson.
Aye.
Representative
Mauer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Rubin. Aye.
Chair Greenman.
Aye. Motion passed. I do want to point out that I put on the record at a hearing after having a discussion with Dr. Goldberg the wrong information about this. I misunderstood what I had heard. Well, my ears, but I really appreciate you coming in. Clarifying for us. I will close the work session on HB 2660 and open a work session on HB 2593. Representative Kotek, you're carrying this from the Policy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Health Policy Subcommittee heard this bill, and we had testimony from a variety of folks, particularly people involved in what we're dealing with here in the state in terms of a shortage in terms of nurses and nurse instructors. What House Bill 2593 does is adds nurses or nurse instructors to the current list of exemptions in the PERS statute. Currently, a nurse or nurse instructor who retires under the PERS system can work up to a certain number of hours, essentially half time, and still retain their PERS benefits. What this would do would be to allow nurses and nurse instructors to be employed full-time or up to full-time with a public employer as a nurse or a nurse instructor. Currently, someone could retire from PERS right now and go out and work in the private sector.
the barrier, coming back into working as a public employer, prohibits nurses and nurse instructors from working, for example, at Oregon Health Sciences University for more than half time to provide their experience in those public institutions, either at correctional facilities, public health departments, any kind of public employer. So the committee supported this bill, and I think with the recognition that we have an issue here, that we have some people with experience that would be nice to have back in working with a public employer, specifically the nurse instructors, I think, was the primary issue, and that I believe we passed this out unanimously.
Yes.
Okay. Great. And I will stop there.
Would you like to put a motion on the floor?
Yes. I would like to move House Bill 2593 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. And rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Oh, and rescind the referral to Ways and Means. The Speaker's given us permission. Turned out the Speaker put anything that, the Speaker's staff put anything that had PERS in it with the subsequent Ways and Means, and it turned out this has no...
has no impact.
No fiscal at all, so they were happy to rescind it, to allow us to rescind it.
So that motion would be with the due pass with the rescinding the referral.
Right. Discussion. Yes, discuss it.
There's an issue when you're involving PERS that we need to remember as a legislature. When we had the PERS crisis in the 03 session, it was as a result of 25 or 30 years of little twists here, little amendments there, let's make a little change here, because after all, every one of them was justified. Last session, we said, you know what, teachers in the rural areas shouldn't be held to this, to the 1,040 hours per year rule, and so let's allow them to also come back after they retire, and it just always gets expanded, and the day's going to come that all these things are going to have a fiscal. This doesn't just say that those who have worked their whole work life and then retired can then come back. What it really says is, as soon as you qualify to retire, you retire.
No, that's not true. It does say, it says in it, only people that have received the full benefit. So it isn't people as soon as they can retire. It's only people that have worked long enough to receive the full PERS benefit. There's language in
okay.
it.
Okay, well, what is that, 57? 58 or 60, well, depends on what tier they're under, but I'm just saying that...
And then they will not receive any other PERS benefits from that time.
During that period of time?
Yeah, during that period of time when they're working, there will not be PERS benefits.
Okay.
All right. So it really does have no effect on PERS.
Well, can we get a clarification?
It's specifically the statute that's referenced that we wouldn't know just by looking at it, but it...
The provision.
Yep. We got all kinds of help coming.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Mr. Gentlemen, both introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of Oregon PERS.
Who's that guy sitting next to
me? Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association.
Thank you, Brian.
Just two clarifications on the points that have been discussed so far. The bill does not apply to an individual who takes early retirement. That is what is referred to, but to Representative Richardson's point of regular retirement, yes, it does apply. To the issue of what benefits, the person continues to draw a PERS retirement benefit. They do not accrue additional retirement benefit during that time period.
Okay. So my point is that the theory with retirement is that you work until you're going to retire, and then other people take over the jobs that you have. What happens is when we make these kinds of changes, and I'm not saying that this specifically is a bad one, I'm just bringing out for the whole world to hear.
I did that already.
What we're doing is saying that when you can retire, you retire, and then you keep working, and now you get two checks. You get your retirement check and your other check, and so it's referred to affectionately as double dipping, but we keep making exceptions, and every one of them is justifiable under the explanation that's given, but they all have extended consequences. And so I'm just mentioning that it's as a PERS lover.
And I'm happy to put on the record, as a conflict of interest, I suppose, the fact that I've retired twice now, and I'm back working again.
And conflicts so
hope to retire a couple more times. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. And I think we had this discussion in the subcommittee, because I think there's that idea of what does retirement actually mean, and I think that's a different discussion about at what age, and
reality is that we have nurses and nurse instructors who are retiring at full benefit at whatever age and whatever tier they're in. And then for whatever reason, they're back in the private sector, and we are losing their experience. And so I agree with you. You can look at the bill. There's a list of exemptions there. And I think because of our shortage issues, this rises to that top. But, you know,
yeah.
Points well taken in terms of what we do with the system. But seems like a helpful exemption to have. So.
Yes, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me, knowing you have a member that wants to leave.
I'm watching the clock very carefully.
I wanted to say I support this because of the issue of the nursing shortage. It's an issue where we do not have enough people coming into these positions. But I do want to reflect on Representative Richardson's point, which is we need to be very careful with these issues because it does become an issue when there is not a worker shortage and there is competition for employment of making it difficult for younger workers to enter the workforce. And I think that it's very important when these issues come up to be sure that we are looking at work shortage issues and not unintentionally crowding younger workers out of the workforce.
This is Mr. Lashman for a comment on that. Does that must be
for the record, Brian Lashman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. That is a consideration. I think the reality of the nursing shortage that we have right now, and they are cyclical. This one is not cyclical. We are talking about the next 15 to 20 years. The average age of nurses right now is over 55 years of age. The average age of nurse instructors is nearly 58 years of age. We have 16 open positions for nurse instructors in the state of Oregon right now that they cannot find anybody to recruit into because they in fact have retired and they can't come back. And as was stated, what's occurring right now is these folks that do want to work additional time do then go to the private sector. So the public sector loses the ability to hire these folks as an instructor. The other example that we brought to you in the subcommittee was the example of nurses working in the KCI Center up at the Hill, in which they're operating room nurses, and they don't have any ability to control their schedule. It's as needed. And so they get toward the end of the year, and they don't know whether they've worked 10:30 or they work 10:45 or 10:49. And there's eight of them up there that work part-time. But depending on what the year's demands are, they get toward the end of the year, and they don't know where they are in this process. And all of those nurses, my understanding, all eight of those nurses are 56 years old or older and all trying to phase out. But your point is well taken about making room for the younger folks coming in. Right now, however, in nursing, there's not enough younger folks coming in that we have that problem.
Is there any further discussion?
Yes, sir.
Please.
What was the vote in the subcommittee?
It was 3-0-2. We had two excused.
You know, I had my say. I understand this is a unique situation, and I really do understand the situation with nursing, and I can see the problem. And so I'll be an eye on this, but only begrudgingly, because it's so easy to get into the system where every exception is justifiable on its own merits, but over time, the exceptions altogether become a huge problem for the system. But I know the average age for nursing, and I know it's not going to get resolved. I was going to say, well, let's just have a sunset in 5 years, but if you're going to have a sunset in 15 years, you might as well just go forward. So,
for the record, Vice Chair Richardson, we appreciate your support.
At our surprise.
Representative Maurer.
Point of clarification, not all nurses.
So you're retired as well, is that right?
Well,
I mean, we might have conflicts of interest there.
Yes, but not from PERS, and I'm not receiving a retirement. Oh. I'll receive it when I turn 60.
Oh, okay.
And not all nursing instructors are over the age of 50. Some of them are below the age of 40. And so I would like to declare a conflict of interest that my wife is an employee of OHSU and a nursing instructor.
May I ask a question?
Please.
Representative Maurer, what is your opinion of this situation since you have a little bit more about this? Do you think that it is as much of a crisis as it's been represented, or do you think that it's not?
I'm being led by Representative Gelser.
Oh, that was just... Sorry, I wasn't leading.
No, I do believe that one of the hurdle, or not hurdles, but one of the barriers to creating, thank you, to creating new nurses in a workforce, whether they're nurse practitioners, RNs, CNAs, that we have several different areas that are we have shortfalls. One is some facility issues. One is areas of preceptorships where they can do their clinical training, and another area is nursing instructors. So in fact, there is a shortage of nursing instructors, not only in the state of Oregon, but I would say across the country. And so I'm going to support this because, I mean, this is a critical area, and it really is those experienced nurses that you need in those instructor, you know, it's beyond instructor mentor roles.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've also been informed by both DOC and DHS that the state hospital under the new plan will need something like 600 more psychiatric nurses. And the Department of Corrections is having a terrible time keeping their nurses, and particularly as we have a propensity to grow more prisons. Okay, we have a motion on the floor. Will the clerk please call the roll? And I'm not going to do that aye or nay thing. You know that by now.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye. Excuse.
Representative Canning.
Excuse.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Delter.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kotek. Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. And Representative Kotek, would you like to carry this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll close the work session on HB 2593 and open a work session on SB 82. And who brought that to us? Is that me?
Well, and Mr. Chair, I'll just bring it up to speed.
Yeah, why don't you do it? Yeah.
Okay. Senate Bill 82 moved out of the Health Policy Committee. Representative Bruin was assigned to be a carrier, but he is excused today. Senate Bill 82, as the Policy Committee will recall, addresses the plano contact lenses, which are decorative or color, and we were shown some pretty amazing designs that people choose to put over their eyes, and the problems that are caused from that, and the fact that these contact lenses are being sold in inappropriate places, flea markets, hair salon, tattoo parlors. In reality, federal law requires that there is a prescription required on it, and we do not have anything on the books that line up with the FDA regulations. So this bill is to not only line us up with the federal regulations, but it is also to put on the books to allow the Board of Optometry to begin going out and educating the non-official eyeglass places, to educate them, put out some outreach efforts, and try to get these contact lenses out of the undesirable locations and into the real reputable locations.
And the vote in the Senate was 28-1, I think?
27-1, with two excused.
We had, for those of you that weren't in the hearings, we had quite a few hearings. I made quite a fuss over whether the language was the right language. We got the president of the board to come up from Southern Oregon and visit with us and talk about it. I spoke today with the AG for the board. It turns out that the language here in 9 really is required that it is to match the federal law, because the contact lenses do say federal law prohibits sales without a prescription. To match that law, we need to put in the state regulations an analogous statement, and that will give the board the authority to begin to regulate them that they need. And they ended up satisfying me, and I was a little skeptical from the beginning. The language seems strange. Not that I think it's a great idea to sell contact lenses in tattoo parlors. So,
question.
Yep.
What is the wrong that we're trying to remedy here? How bad is the eye damage that's occurring?
Would you like to join us?
Significant. eye damage, infection, blindness, which I think you'll hear.
Do you log in?
Yes, I'm David Plunkett, Executive Director of the Board of Optometry. And to answer your question, Representative Richardson, as already indicated, the eye damage can be quite extensive, even in the loss of eyesight. So it's a pretty serious issue. Yeah. What this bill does is...
Can I just to get to the heart of the matter, bicycles cause death, okay? I'd like to know, what is the frequency? You know, how many of these things are sold? How widely are they used? What is the frequency of infections and blindness?
I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to all the. I don't have the statistics on that, but you understand this was a federal law that required this. So the federal law requires that there is a prescription in order to sell these lenses. And the federal government, before they did that, they went through an extensive study on this. As a matter of fact, a couple years, they actually declassified these and made them cosmetics, and complaints started coming out of the woodwork, and that's when they went through this quite extensive process of having hearings, looking at the stats, and then they went ahead and classified them again as medical devices, as regular contact lenses are.
Can you continue? So there was a period of time that they were classified, and then they came off of classification. You know how long they were off classification? I mean, that helps, because it means it's been looked at. I mean, the mere fact the federal government says to do it, I mean, I trust them, but not in everything, you know.
Representative Richardson, yes, that was a two-year period, as I understand, yes.
Okay. All right. I guess you don't have numbers.
You get to see all the nice contact lenses.
Yeah,
on one more page.
Well, and I don't. If somebody wants to do this, it's like, how about sunglasses? I mean, if you got in a crash, they've broken your lens, you could go blind. The point is, somebody's going to be stupid enough to put it on their eye. I don't think we need to pass laws against stupidity. But
I'd like that.
Well, enforcing it could be a difficult problem.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I believe that's outside the scope of our committee.
It's relating clause, too. A challenge is whether or not it's really necessary for us to do this. Now, if I'm in optometry and I can get something to be forced to where only optometrists can do it, then by golly, I'm not a neutral person anymore. Not that we'd say you're biased, but you have a stake in the outcome. And nobody else is speaking that's selling these things or that, so it's just in behalf of those that will benefit from this legislation, it's a good idea, and I understand that. And 21 votes on the Senate side means that, they certainly believe that it's a good idea. 27? Okay, 27, that's a good thing. I just was trying, I had not looked at this subject before, and so rather than just go on without asking anything, I kind of wanted to know more about it. Well, you did listen.
I push on very hard. And, of course, one of the issues is they are selling them illegally. There's no question about that.
But the federal government's not going to come in and do anything about it. So it's really to give the local people the authority to enforce what is the law.
Of course, the FDA is not known for being unbiased in a lot of different areas.
I've heard that.
Absolutely. So when the FDA says, we're here to help, I understand that.
Absolutely heard that. Representative Maurer?
Yes. Chair, who testified? Was it Dr. Walters? Scott Walters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was. It was Dr. Walters.
Okay. Well, I can vouch for Dr. Walters as being a very reputable source. Representative Richardson, Dr. Walters is a very reputable source, and I would trust the information since I've known him since I was knee-high to a basketball.
Scott Walters, yes.
He's from Cape Falls.
Okay. No, not Cape Falls.
Grants Pass.
Grants Pass.
Yes.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize because I missed the public hearing on this earlier. Does this affect consumers' ability to, for example, order from 1-800-CONTACTS?
Mm-hmm. Representative Greenlick, Representative Bonamici, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
Not going to enforce that.
It does not restrain the selling of contact lenses at all. All it does is require that if you want to buy them, you must have a prescription, which the federal law requires, and you must then the seller must obtain that prescription. That means that they have been examined by a doctor and they have been fitted.
Thank you.
That's a good question.
Well, because I looked at it, I can't tell.
It's, uh-huh. And it's probably not going to stop you from buying them at a tattoo parlor, either, because they're not going to be able to enforce every tattoo parlor in the state.
Mr. Chair? Are you looking at me as an alternate?
I am. Yeah,
okay,
no, sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. I think that when we had this discussion in the public hearing the other week, while it would be difficult to track people down and have the resources to police this, what it does is it gives the Board of Optometry the ability to address the issue. Certainly, this isn't going to ensure that nobody ever goes to a flea market and buys a contact lens. As you pointed out, we can't regulate ill-inspired behavior and consumer choices, but we can empower the Board of Optometry to regulate those that sell and make clear what the standards are, and that when it says on the bottom of the product, prescription required for sale, that you really should be taking that seriously, that prescription is required for sale.
Yeah, I find this very interesting. You know, as an ex-pharmacist, you have all these bottles in the drugstore, and it says may not be sold without a prescription, all these things, and you know, and you somehow just can't imagine a tattoo parlor having
a dozen bottles of a cholesterol-lowering drug or something that they're selling without a prescription.
It just sort of doesn't happen, and this is happening. It's
Mr.
just a little weird.
The focus is on this one little aspect of a very broadly worded clause, and Representative Bonamici has said that what she's brought out is that if I wore contacts, and I've had the same prescription for several years, and I go on the internet and want to order a replacement to them, I can't do that now because I have to call an ophthalmologist or an optometrist and go get a valid, unexpired prescription.
Which is a year.
Which is a year. And so now I can't use the internet. I can't go and buy any my regular contact lenses without going and getting another examination, even though it's only been 13 months.
But the point is that's true now.
It may or may not be true, but
I mean, it's essentially true now. You cannot do that now legally. That's the point.
All you're saying is this is a federal. There's a federal rule that the FDA has gotten in, and it's solved one problem. But now it's going to be a state rule as well, and it's going to prevent our citizens who haven't had a prescription in 13 months from getting some duplicate contacts.
Mr. Chair, if it helps clarify things just a little bit about practice. I don't wear contact lenses, but both my kids do. And last time, and I have ordered them from 1-800-CONTACTS or an internet site because, frankly, they're cheap. And I'm getting a particular brand in a particular box, and yes, they have prescriptions. And I think last time I did that, the company insisted that either I fax them the prescription or they called the doctor to make sure that the prescription was
So they are selling them legally over the internet.
Yes, that's good to hear because 1-800-CONTACTS was one of the vendors that there were national problems with, and they did agree to sell them based on a prescription that is required by federal law, and so it's good that they're doing that.
Any other comments? Do we have a motion on the floor?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move that we send Senate Bill 82 with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Is there any discussion?
Yes. Might we add a due pass recommendation?
Yes, with a due pass.
Oh, with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
I'll be voting no on it.
Okay. Will the assistant please call the roll?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Brooks.
Excused.
Representative Cannon.
Excused.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gilford.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Potek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
No.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. And we'll ask Representative Bruin to carry it to the floor.
Oh, excellent. Representative Gilford asked.
Oh, you would like to carry it? Absolutely. Representative Gilford will carry it to the floor. Bruin snoozes, he loses.
Can I request that you bring visual aids?
Where are visual aids?
To wear visual
only
aids?
Only if you have a prescription.
Only you don't need one. Yeah.
Certainly, I'll bring them by your office.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's actually helpful to see.
And it might be fun to put a floor letter out that has all those snake ones as well. I close the work session on Senate Bill 82. And unless anything else is to come before the committee, I'll adjourn the committee.